Hello, everyone. Thank you for spending your lunch hour with us today on our e-learning session. Today, myself, Alex, and my colleague, Alexandra, are going to be talking about understanding the importance of employment agreements and handbooks. So a very, very important topic in our area of expertise, and so we're going to run through a whole bunch of stuff. But before we start that, just a few reminders. First, if you have any questions at all during the presentation, feel free to use the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen and just type out your question and submit it. We will do our best to answer those questions during the presentation or at the end if we have time. If we run out of time, we will have our client care team reach out to you to set up a call with an advisor to go through that. Also, if you've missed any of our previous presentations or e-learnings, you can find the recordings over at e2rsolutions.com, and the PowerPoint presentations can be found in your member portals. As it relates to today's presentation, we are going to be covering a lot of information, useful information to revisit over the coming weeks or months, so please feel free to utilize your member portal for that. Lastly, we just want to take this opportunity to remind you all that this information is an overview only and it is not intended as an analysis of all areas of employment and labor law, and accordingly should not be relied upon as legal advice for any given situation. So if you have any specific questions related to the information that we covered today or any other topic, please let us know and we will be happy to set up a specific call with an advisor. Lastly, our next e-learning presentation for October will be held October 25th, and details will follow with regards to the topic of that presentation. And so without further delay, let's start today's presentation. Again, we are talking about understanding the importance of employment agreements and handbooks. Those are the fundamental two pieces of paper you are going to want to have in your workplace. And so let's run through a quick agenda as it relates to what we will be covering today. The first section is the employment agreement. We will run through the dangers of oral agreements and kind of why you don't want to make oral agreements or how to avoid some of the pitfalls associated therewith. We're going to review the basics, kind of employment agreements 101, ensure enforceability, those types of things. Then we are going to go through what I believe is the fundamental provision in your employment contracts, and that is the termination provision. We're going to go through some issues related to mitigation and mitigation language in the contracts, also restrictive covenants, the bonus plan. There's some recent case law on that issue, so we're going to run through some of those issues there and then give you some final suggestions on employment agreements. Then the second half of this presentation, we are going to highlight the employee handbook. Obviously, we're going to outline what the benefits of an employee handbook are. We're going to run through some of the required policies and why they are required at law, as well as some of the recommended policies. Some of those very key policies you're going to want to have as part of your workplace infrastructure. And then lastly, again, we will run through some final suggestions as it relates to employee handbooks. And so I'm going to pass the mic over to my colleague, Alexandra, and she's going to speak to the employment agreement.
Okay, so having an employment agreement in place is one of the single most important documents an organization can utilize. All employees should have one. I don't care if they're seasonal, fixed term, student, hourly salary, everyone should have one. They're fundamental to the employer-employee relationship and should be used consistently. They set up the terms and conditions of employment and those obligations that survive the employment relationship, including confidentiality and non-solicitation. They're also super helpful because they can provide certainty as to issues such as compensation issues that arise after resignation or termination of employment, which we'll get into later. Having a good contract that describes the relationship you want to have with an employee can take a little bit of time and money, and I can understand and appreciate that sometimes we're in a rush to hire somebody and have them start, but having an enforceable employment agreement is in place is well worth it, and it could save you significant financial consequences down the line. For example, having an enforceable termination provision can significantly limit a company's financial obligations when terminating an employee. Our position is that an enforceable termination provision can typically reduce a company's severance exposure by up to 75%. That's certainly substantial. They also enhance the value for a company, which means more money for the owners in the event there's ever a sale of the business as well.
So if any of you have ever had a call with me, you've probably had me ask you some of the following questions. And so on this slide here, you're going to see a bit of a flow chart where there's four key questions that need to be answered in the affirmative if you're going to feel good about the enforceability of your contract down the road. And so the first question is, mainly, does your organization use employment agreements? If the question is no, shame. As Alexander pointed out earlier, we recommend that you use employment agreements for all manner of employees, full-time, part-time, seasonal, etc. Because the failure to do so is going to result in significant exposure to the organization upon a termination, as well as maybe some confusion as it relates to the obligations each party has to one another or what the expectations are. As we've discussed previously, I'm sure, in your contracts, you have the ability, and we'll get to it in further detail later, but you have the ability to significantly reduce your exposure, perhaps even limiting your exposure to the minimum amount of notice, which is far less than you may owe or what a court may deem you to have owed an individual who does not have an enforceable contract with an enforceable termination provision. So first and foremost, do you use employment agreements? If the answer is no, you should, and if it's yes, we can go on to the second question, which is, does the employment contract contain that enforceable termination provision? Again, if it doesn't, we're going to want to revisit that issue because, quite frankly, that is going to be the most important provision in your employment agreement. As Alexandra pointed out, the stats are pretty clear as it relates to the exposure number. You're looking at perhaps up to 75% more of a termination cost if you don't have a valid termination provision. And so we're going to want to make sure that that is in there and updated regularly because, as you've seen from some of our alerts or some of our conversations, the law is ever evolving in this area, and our courts are giving us more guidance each passing month as it relates to what needs to be in there in order for that termination provision to be enforceable. The next issue or question really is going to be, did the employee sign the contract before they started work for you? This is of fundamental importance, and we'll get to why that is in a moment, but if the answer is no and they signed it mid-employment, there may be an issue with enforceability, and if the contract's not enforceable, not going to be worth the paper it's written on. So we need to make sure that we are giving our candidates a copy of the agreement before and requiring it to be signed before. Now, there's a recent case that provides some good news as it relates to signing the contract after the start date, where the employee had the contract before the start date, but I would rather have a conversation with a client knowing that that contract was signed in advance of the start date to feel good about the enforceability of that agreement. And the last question is, do you update the agreements on a regular basis? Now, as I noted, our courts are giving us lots and lots of things to read about what needs to be in a termination provision in order for it to be enforceable and protect your organization. So we want to update those as regularly as possible, and the best way to do that is if there's a promotion or a bonus or a substantial raise, reach out to us. We have a discussion about the existing contract. If there's issues there as it relates to enforceability or the language, we're going to want to use that opportunity to get that existing employee on a contract. And so Moving on to the next slide, Alexander is going to speak about the dangers of oral agreements, and then we can come back to the enforceability of contracts overall in a bit.
Okay, so oral agreements, you want to avoid them. You can still have an employment agreement that's verbal, but it's not something that we recommend. Now, in order for there to be an employment agreement, there needs to be a clear offer. That clear offer needs to be accepted, and there needs to be valid consideration. And typically, when oral agreements are made, typically the consideration is the job itself. That's what is of value to the employee. So our position is that oral agreements are a no-no. They're difficult to prove. When contested, written agreements, you know, contain termination provisions, and they create clarity for both parties. Oral statements made in the interview may be characterized as offers of employment that are capable of acceptance by the candidate. So interviewers, when you're conducting an interview and you're offering an applicant a job, you need to make it clear that the formal offer of employment will be made in writing and it will include all the terms and conditions of employment. And until then, no statements are to be considered a formal offer of employment. We typically, in the employment agreements that we draft for all of you, also include language in the employment agreement that says, you know, this constitutes the entire offer and supersedes all prior agreements, oral or otherwise. We try to kind of put in the saving provision in the agreement. But even with that, we want to be very careful about the language that you're using in interviewing any candidate or potential employee. So like I mentioned, an oral offer that is accepted is an employment agreement that is enforceable in law. So now I'm going to speak a little bit about just the basics. Oh, sorry, I jumped ahead. Alex is going to take it away with talking about what makes an employment agreement enforceable.
Thanks very much. So as Alexander is mentioning, we're going to want to avoid being in a situation whereby the employee is going to be able to say, I have an oral contract. The written contract is not enforceable. And so we do that by doing a number of things, one of which, as Alexandra mentioned, is ensuring that we tell the candidate that the offer isn't going to be finalized until they receive it in writing. And so now we've given them the contract in writing. We want to make sure that it's enforceable. And obviously, before employment commences, as I noted during our four key question component, we want to always ensure that the contract is signed before the candidate starts employment. And so that goes hand in hand with also, if it's possible, giving the candidate some time to review the contract before signing it back. I understand you often will have times where you need someone to start immediately or soon after an offer is made. And so I'm not overly fussed, although my preference would be to give them time. I'm not overly fussed if it isn't the kind of standard 5 days to review the contract. But what I am fussed about and what I want to make sure everyone's doing is making sure their managers are clearly communicating to the candidates and making sure they're getting those contracts back before the start date. If worse comes to worse, there is some support for the idea of a contract signed after the start date, but that's only if we can establish that the candidate was provided the written contract before they started, not on their start date, not at lunchtime of their first day, but the day before that they were given that contract and we didn't substantially change that contract. Now, oftentimes when we have clients jump on board with us, they haven't been using contracts or their contracts need a bit of work. And so the question ultimately becomes, what about those people that are already working for me? How do I get them on enforceable contracts? And so one way is through normal attrition or through promotions, or if you're introducing a new kind of bonus structure or benefits, we can then, at that point, as long as it's made clear to the candidate before we formally offer that promotion or that benefit, that in order to get that additional benefit, they need to sign a written contract. That's one way to get those employees one by one on an enforceable contract. The other way to do it would be to consider perhaps a signing bonus that, again, is conditional upon them signing the contract. And if they don't sign the contract, they don't get that that bonus or that promotion. So it needs to be very clearly communicated, preferably in writing, that the offer of additional, what we call consideration, is conditional upon them signing back that contract. And so, speaking to the ideal process as it relates to contract enforceability, you want to provide the candidate with a written agreement. You want to provide them with some time. Again, I'm not overly fussed with it being 5 days, but some time is better than no time. And then we also want to ensure, despite the recent case law, that they have signed the contract back before the start date or before they receive that additional benefit if they are an existing employee. And if we have those three things, I feel really good about the ability to enforce that contract and hopefully if it has a good termination provision to reduce your exposure if the relationship goes sideways.
Okay, now I'm going to review some of the basics. So any employment agreement that you give an employee should comply with the minimum employment standards legislation. Now, this legislation will provide details regarding minimum wage, hours of work, severance pay, vacation, and you can't contract out of this. You should also consider whether the agreement is going to be for an indefinite term or a fixed term. If it's a fixed term agreement, there's going to be some things that we need to consider in the termination provision. Termination provisions in a fixed term agreement are different than indefinite term. There needs to be language that provides that in the event we terminate prior to the end of the term, the employee won't be entitled to be paid for the balance of the term. If that language isn't in the fixed term agreement, you're potentially on the hook for the rest of the term. So obviously that's very different than an indefinite term agreement. So make sure we're accounting for that when we're issuing those fixed term agreements to employees.
And just one quick point. That applies in all of the common law provinces. In the province of Quebec, there are some differences as it relates to fixed term contracts. And so we want to be mindful of those. So when speaking with an advisor about fixed term contracts in Quebec, we're going to want to highlight some of the additional exposures that relate to those types of agreements. And so if you hear Quebec, always have a little bit of some spidey sense going on and reach out to the advisor. Let them know you're thinking about bringing someone on a fixed term in Quebec, and we'll talk you through that process because if it's not done properly, there could be some additional exposure you have to pay to the end of that fixed term contract.
Another thing to keep in mind is just keep it simple. Use plain language. Offers of employment can also be conditional on things like verifying immigration status, conducting a criminal background check, credit checks, reference checks. Now, if a condition is not met, the employer can decide not to hire that individual or revoke the offer, so long as that language is in the contract. Although this may give rise to notice of termination obligations under the employment standards legislation if there's been a delay in determining whether one of those preconditions has been satisfied. Some other points to consider is that the employment agreement should include, some of these seem obvious, but you'd be surprised, the parties to the agreement, the start date of employment, and if it's a fixed term, the end date, the duties and responsibilities of the employee. You might want to attach a formal job description, how they're going to be remunerated for their work. We always recommend attaching any commission or bonus plan documentation to the employment agreement itself, the duration of the probationary period, what the hours of work are, and whether they will be compensated for overtime or whether they're exempt, their vacation entitlement, what are their responsibilities upon resignation, what, most importantly, what are the company's obligations upon termination, both for cause and without cause, how the employment agreement interacts with the employee handbook, and just to note that this isn't a comprehensive list. Employment agreements obviously should be customized based on your particular company's needs, but just wanted to give you a few big picture items.
And so one of those, again, probably the most important provision in your contract is going to be that termination provision. And the reason is it gives us as an organization the ability to clearly outline what is owed upon termination. So we don't have a situation where some judge is going to rule on what amount of notice is owed. as I'm sure many of us have spoken about before, the common law isn't an exact science. There is no set formula as it relates to what an employee is owed. And so we want to have some certainty there in terms of your costs. And again, it does help as it relates to a sale of a business for the purchaser jumping into a relationship knowing exactly what it would cost to get rid of certain people if the time came. And so employment standards sets the minimum amount of notice. So the first thing you need to be aware of is that your contracts cannot provide for less than minimum standard requirements. And so across all provinces, each province has minimum standard legislation that outlines the amount of notice, and that's going to vary. As well, Ontario and under the Canada Labor Code, which is the legislation governing organizations that are governed federally, they also add what's known as statutory severance pay. And those two concepts are slightly different in Ontario and under the Canada Labor Code, but it is an additional amount of money that needs to be provided to certain employees as soon as they qualify. Now, from a qualifying perspective, we're looking at what's known as the probationary period. Now, each act or code or what have you doesn't specify a certain period of time as a probationary period, but it does specify that after a certain amount of service, an employee is entitled to notice. And so across all provinces, except for what follows, that typical period of time is 3 months. Now, Manitoba is unique in the sense that it's only 30 days, and so we're going to want to make sure that the language drafted in the contract clearly provides that after the 30-day probationary period, they are entitled to notice. We don't want to have a mistake whereby we say 3 months somewhere else and then say no notice is owed, because I've run into that situation whereby we're looking at something that might be offside with legislation. And then the other provinces where there's a different probationary period or an amount of service required to be entitled to notice of termination is New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and the Yukon, where there is a 6 month kind of waiting period before someone is entitled to notice of termination. Again, this is what our courts have been telling us time and time again. The termination provision cannot provide for less than minimum standards, whether that's at the current time of termination or some point in the future. And so we need to be mindful of setting a cap on the amount of termination pay or notice that's not going to be less than possibly their overall entitlement after years and years of service. So oftentimes we'll see a contract in Ontario that says you'll get notice of termination up to 6 months notice. Well, unfortunately, if that person is in Ontario, 6 months could be less than their minimum entitlement at some point in the future, and thereby we're exposing ourselves to a pretty good argument from plaintiff's counsel that the contract is not enforceable. And so without a termination provision or a properly drafted provision, an employee is able to claim common law reasonable notice. And I'm sure many of you have seen lawyers' letters from former employees asking for the sun, moon, and stars. And unfortunately, while those requests are unreasonable more often than not, the question is what is owed, and it's not certain. So we're not in a great position to argue a lesser amount is owed because we just don't know. So I rather eliminate any argument over notice period with the other side by ensuring that we do have a contract with an enforceable provision, because otherwise you will owe common law notice. That amount is going to be uncertain, but I can definitely tell you that that amount will eclipse the statutory minimum amount in more cases than not. Let's continue. There is no calculator as relates to what the common law notice is. Again, it's uncertain, and uncertainty makes us as lawyers and you as HR professionals very uncomfortable. The factors that our courts will look at in assessing reasonable notice are obviously the length of the employee's service time, and that could include even periods of service after there is a break in service. So, for example, there are cases out there where an employee worked for 3 years, left for 3 years, came back for 10, and a court will then look at that employee as a 13-year employee as opposed to like their last previous period of employment. So they'll look at their entirety of service with you in terms of how much notice is owed. On the also on that point as well, short service employees tend to get a disproportionate amount of notice, so we can't necessarily argue, well, they've only been employed with us for a year, they're only owed 1 month notice. Unfortunately, our courts deem short service as being a hindrance to finding new employment. Perhaps in the eyes of new employers, the questions are raised, why did this person only work there for such a short period of time, et cetera, et cetera. Especially high earners, they're going to get a disproportionate amount of notice. And there are cases out there where someone may have been employed for only 8 months and they've gotten a notice period that actually eclipses their service with you. So that's that uncertainty we spoke about. They're also going to take into account the person's age. The older the person is, the longer that notice period is going to be. So there is going to be a bump on top of what ordinarily would be owed for reasonable notice based upon age. On the character of employment issues, again, higher earners will take longer to find and replace their income, it's just a matter of fact, and so they tend to get longer notice periods. And while the economic climate is an issue, and we want to argue sometimes during periods of recession that less notice is owed because, quite frankly, they lost their job, it wasn't our fault, times are tough, et cetera, our courts are not particularly concerned with our organization's financial situation. They are concerned, however, with how long it might take that person to find a new job. And if we're in a recession, arguments are going to be made that that notice period should be longer. And one of the final points, and there are a number of other factors that our courts do look at, but one of the other factors that we do need to look at is whether that person was recruited from secure employment. There are a number of cases where an employee was actively recruited to leave a secure job, especially jobs where they've been at for a long time, and if we turn around and terminate them, our courts may give them some credit, maybe not full credit, but at least some credit for their service time with the other employer. So you're not only paying for the service time with you, you're paying for the service time with their prior employer. So that's going to be, again, an uncertain factor. So all of which is to say, let's get rid of the common law altogether and make sure we have an enforceable termination provision so we don't run into these issues. And so I know just quickly on this no formula business, our courts have shot down the idea of this rough rule of thumb, 1 month per year of service. It is still a guide that most lawyers and judges will use, and you'll see that most awards that do go to trial will shake out at 1 month per year of service, give or take some of those extreme factors such as age, recruitment, and also the character of employment. But you can be pretty certain that a letter is going to at least ask for a month per year of service if you get one from an attorney for a former employee. And in terms of upper limits, there were some cases a few years ago that said the upper limit is 24 months regardless of service. That is still a soft upper limit, but our courts have recently gone above and beyond that in exceptional cases. So not all cases, but certain cases whereby the person has been with you for over, say, 24 years, they're of an advanced age, et cetera, they have no qualms in going over that soft cap. So there is no cap on notice officially, and so it is possible that you may owe more than 24 months notice. I'm going to pass it over to Alexandra. She's going to continue this discussion on termination provisions. Hopefully I didn't kind of step on some of the things she's going to talk about, but take it away.
Okay, so a breach or even a potential breach of the employment standards legislation will render termination provision invalid. So, and if it's invalid, like Alex just explained, that employee is going to be entitled to common law reasonable notice, which we want to avoid at all costs. So potential breach, what does that mean? So if a clause, for example, provides for 30 days notice of a termination without cause, that would comply with most legislation, at least in the first few years. However, as that individual gains seniority, eventually they're going to be entitled to more than 30 days. So most case law across Canada has held that clauses such as that, that allow for that kind of potential breach, will not be enforceable. So this concept was considered recently in an Ontario Court of Appeal decision. In this instance, the employee was on a one-year fixed-term employment agreement and was terminated within the first 3 months. Now, the termination provision in that employment agreement said that the employer could terminate without cause, without giving any notice. So the Court of Appeal found that because it said that and because that was contrary to the legislation, because after 3 months, that employee would be entitled to at least 1 week of notice or pay in lieu, it violated the ESA because it was a potential future breach. And then the employee was awarded the balance of the term. Because it was a fixed-term agreement, we kind of set that out earlier. Fixed-term agreements, super risky. If you don't have an enforceable employment agreement, not only could you be on the hook for common law reasonable notice, but potentially the end of the term. So the takeaway in this instance is that it appears to be absolutely settled, at least in Ontario, but arguably in the other provinces as well, that if a termination provision provides less than the employment standards legislation, either now or at any point in the future, it will not be enforceable. Okay, so now I'm going to chat about some Ontario-specific considerations. So in Ontario, the failure of a termination provision to provide for the continuation of benefits and statutory severance pay in the event of a termination without cause may render the provision invalid. So there was a recent Ontario Court of Appeal case. The employee was a sales and events planner that was terminated without cause, and the employee brought a motion arguing that the termination clause in the employment agreement was unenforceable and was looking for 12 months of pay in lieu of notice. So the employment agreement, in the employment agreement, the termination clause did not clearly indicate that the employer would contribute to the employee's benefit plan during the notice period. The termination clause also failed to provide Wood with statutory severance pay. So the Ontario Court of Appeal found that because the termination provision contravened the ESA, because it failed to mention the benefit continuance and statutory severance pay, it was invalid. Now, it's interesting because the employer did contribute to the benefit plan, did continue benefits throughout the statutory notice period, but it's important to note that just because you comply with the ESA, if that language isn't in the termination provision itself, it's still going to be unenforceable. Now, one thing to note in this case is that it didn't have a saving provision that explicitly stated that if the clause currently or in the future fails to comply with the employment standards legislation, it should be interpreted as complying. We think that if it had, there would have been a strong argument that it was enforceable. So when we're drafting employment agreements for you, we're always going to make sure that we include that saving provision.
Also, one of the things you might want to consider, and we'll go through why in a minute through these couple slides here, is the issue of addressing mitigation in the termination provision. So mitigation is a contractual law concept that essentially says if there's a breach of contract, a person who is injured, quote unquote, the person who has the contract breached against them, is obligated to minimize their loss. And so in the employment context, this means going out and seeking new employment. And so oftentimes we will argue that an employee has failed to mitigate as it relates to their reasonable notice by not looking for a job or not accepting a position. And if that argument is successful, then we do get perhaps a credit issued towards the amount of notice that would have otherwise been owed by our courts. And so if an employee does mitigate as well, then there is almost a dollar for dollar reduction on your common law exposure. Obviously, that excludes minimum statutory entitlements. Those are never subject to mitigation, but the common law portion can be. Likewise, you can also have a provision in your contract that provides for more notice of termination, so over and above the minimum, and also make that additional amount subject to mitigation. So Alexandra is going to quickly run through some recent cases as it relates to the importance of accounting for mitigation in a termination provision and some of the arguments that our courts will allow an employer to make in that regard.
One thing to just remember when it comes to mitigation is that mitigation efforts, the employee's duty to mitigate does not mean that that employee is obligated to accept the first job offer received. So in a recent Alberta decision, this is considered. The employee was employed as the director of asset operations, and he was terminated without cause. 2 months after termination, he was offered a position by another company, but he declined on the basis that the compensation was lower than he had been earning at his previous job and because it offered no possibility of career advancement. The employee brought summary judgments seeking wrongful dismissal damages, and the employee was ultimately awarded 4 months. The court noted that while the employee had an obligation to mitigate, that it did not mean that the employee had to take the first job offer. In this case, by waiting another month or two, the employee was able to find a more attractive job at a higher salary and that had better prospects for career advancement and development. So the court concluded that the employee made a reasoned decision regardless of what precise level of proposed compensation was and regardless of the precise start date of the new job. So just one thing to consider. Also, when it comes to mitigation, I think that if you're going to offer in a termination provision any gratuitous benefit over and above the employment standards legislation, you should consider including mitigation language. One case in Ontario that recently came out, the employee entered into an employment agreement that provided that he would receive 6 months of notice or pay in lieu in the event of a without cause termination. But the provision was silent on the duty to mitigate. So when the employee was terminated, the termination letter said that he would receive the agreed upon amount of 6 months, but that he was required to seek alternative employment during that 6 month period. So 2 weeks into that 6 month period, the employee secures new employment at the same salary, and all of a sudden the employer ceases to make payments. The employee is confused. He argues that the sum that he was entitled to was set out in the employment agreement and that it never set out any duty to mitigate. The court agreed with him, held that by defining a specific notice entitlement in the employment agreement, the employer had not enforced the duty to mitigate and it didn't apply. So unless an actual provision is in the contract as it relates to the duty to mitigate, you're not going to be able to enforce that. So just consider that on a go-forward basis if a termination provision provides for a greater benefit than the employment standards minimums.
One additional point on mitigation before we move on to the next slide. As mitigation is going to be a live issue oftentimes in a constructive dismissal case, and so we're going to want to go through whether the employee is obligated to mitigate in a constructive dismissal context. And then there also is the opportunity, perhaps, to offer a candidate to return to work in a different or the same position with the same employer. It's a unique circumstance, but it does arise at times, especially if the termination isn't an acrimonious termination, and so mitigation will also be a live issue there. So just mitigation will come up oftentimes as it relates to both the employment contracts and the amounts owed thereunder, as well as in the run-of-the-mill employment termination context, whether that's a wrongful dismissal or a constructive dismissal. So we'll always talk about mitigation if it's a live issue, and just so you have a better understanding of that concept in general. One of the more, I guess, probably the second or third most important kind of stuff to put in a contract, apart from the termination provision and just the basics as it relates to the employment relationship, are provisions protecting your organization's interests. And so typically these come in the form of what are known overall as restrictive covenants. And so organizations attempt to put some restrictions on the post-employment activity and also during employment activity of their employees to protect their business interests. And so these restrictions obviously are not going to be enforceable across the board. And in fact, the general perception from our courts is that they are going to be unenforceable unless the employer can establish that, A, the provision is reasonable, And we'll talk to that in terms of what needs to, what reasonable means, but also necessary to protect your business interests. And so there are two primary kind of categories of restrictive covenants. There are the non-solicitation provisions, which generally restrict an employee's ability to seek out business of your existing customers or clients. We're also trying to also prevent them from kind of recruiting employees to leave your organization to join their new employer or their own startup. And then as it relates to those types of provisions, what is reasonable is going to be determined by the scope of the provision. So the length of time, the geographical scope in terms of how far reaching that is going to be on a geographical level. And so we're going to always want to make sure that that is reasonable, and we'll get to exactly what that means in a second. The second type of restrictive covenant is known as the non-competition provision. And I can tell you that that provision, which wholly restricts a person from joining a competitor for a set period of time, is going to be unenforceable in many cases. Our courts simply do not want to have a restraint in trade. They do not believe it is reasonably necessary to protect your interests by preventing someone to work for a competitor. And so more often than not, our courts will not enforce a non-competition provision in an employment agreement. They may enforce it in a commercial contract, for example, a sale of business contract, but likely not in the employment context. And so one of the recent things that have kind of popped up over the past few years is this non-competition language kind of jumping or kind of showing up in a non-solicitation provision. And essentially, like you see the case reference there, it's the Donaldson Travel case where the restriction went beyond active solicitation and in fact prevented the employee from accepting the business of the former employer's clients. Now, accepting business is different than solicitation, and that's known as a non-dealing provision. And our courts will not find a non-dealing provision to be a non-solicitation provision. A non-dealing provision is essentially a non-competition provision in the court's eyes. And so if there is non-dealing language or accepting of business language in your non-solicitation provisions, the whole provision may fail. And so we want to make sure that when we're drafting non-solicitation provisions that we're clearly limiting it to the active solicitation of clients and not restricting someone from dealing with or accepting the business if that client approaches that former employee on their own accord. Otherwise, we're going to lose the protection of an otherwise valid non-solicitation provision. And lastly, if we get it wrong, our courts are not going to fix it for us. They're not going to kind of scratch out the offending words. So if it says, I will not solicit or accept business from my former employer's clients, they're not going to cross out the accept business part and enforce the rest of it. They will just cross out the whole provision and you will have no protection. So we want to make sure that that is drafted properly.
Okay, now we're going to talk about bonus plans and how to deal with them in the employment contract. So our recommendation is that you make sure the bonus plan is incorporated into the written terms of the employment agreement and brought to the employee's attention prior to the commencement of employment. There was a recent decision, Paquette in Ontario, that we wanted to chat about. The employee had 14 years of service and was terminated without cause. The employee had participated in a bonus plan. This bonus plan was separate and apart from the employment agreement and provided that the employee had to be actively employed in order to receive payment of the bonus. He sued for wrongful dismissal after the termination. He was awarded 17 months of pay in lieu of notice, calculated on his base salary and benefits, and he was also looking for compensation by way of the bonus. He wanted his kind of prorated bonus over that 17-month notice period. This relief was denied by the motion judge, and then he appealed successfully at the Court of Appeal. So the Court of Appeal considered, what is this employee's common law entitlement, including whether under the common law he would be entitled to a bonus during his reasonable notice period, and what and if there was specific wording in the bonus plan that altered or removed the employee's common law entitlement. So ultimately, like I mentioned before, the court found the employee was entitled to the bonus over the reasonable notice period. So active employment in that bonus plan, it didn't save the employer in this instance. The claim, keep in mind that his claim wasn't for a bonus under the plan terms, but rather was a claim for damages in lieu of the bonus, and such an award was warranted because the bonus was a significant part of his remuneration, and the employer was entitled to common law reasonable notice. So the takeaways, when drafting a bonus plan, make sure there's limiting language that's clear. You want to have language that clearly sets out the entitlement that employee has upon resignation or termination. You always want to have a clear termination provision that outs the common law while addressing that bonus payments, if any, are not payable. And if a plan requires active employment and there's a valid enforceable termination provision that includes the common law, you're in good shape and unearned bonus payments are likely not owed on a prorated basis through the termination date or through any common law reasonable notice period.
Let's quickly just kind of summarize the employment agreement section of this presentation. Again, these will be found on your member portal afterwards. All the slides and the information, there is a lot to digest here, so I strongly recommend or encourage you guys to revisit that. But first and foremost, I want to ensure that the employment agreements are given to all employees, that they are drafted clearly, and that they comply with both applicable legislation and the common law. Again, we're going to want to use them for all manner of employees, whether full-time, part-time, hourly, salaried. There's no reason not to use it for everybody. We want to make sure that expectations are clear for everybody. Our exposure is limited for everybody. To ensure enforceability, like we went through that basic formula earlier, but essentially, we want to make sure that they are given the contract in advance of the employee's start date, not on the day of the start date or not after the start date unless there's new kind of valid consideration being provided to them. We're going to want to make sure we set out all the terms and conditions. We don't want to be in a situation where we said, oh, well, it's obvious that we expect you to do this, but we didn't put it in the contract. That's not going to be a great situation to be in, so make sure that all the expectations as it relates to the position are outlined in the contract. Also address any post-employment situations in the contract as well. We're going to want to make sure that those are drafted for the reasons we previously discussed. Again, always good to have explicit conditions so the argument down the road isn't, well, I didn't know, it's not in my contract. That's going to be of no use to anybody. And we're also going to want to review those contracts on a regular basis. We don't mind here at E2R looking at your existing contracts, updating those where applicable. We want to avoid the use of ongoing old kind of language because then we're in a situation where we might run into issues where the contract isn't enforceable because it's old language. So always use a promotion or something as a reason to review the contract and update it where appropriate. Now Alexandra is going to highlight some of the benefits as to why you should be using an employee handbook in your organization, and she'll take it away.
Okay, so why should your organization have an employee handbook? So an employee handbook clearly outlines the policies and procedures to answer the employee's questions and to avoid confusion. It's a great onboarding document to have. It's nice when you started a company and you get provided something like a handbook that kind of keeps you up to date and allows you to understand how the processes and policies of the company work. The employee handbook reduces the risk of legal disputes and or litigation. There's some policies that are legally required that a company has, and those can be communicated to an employee by using the employee handbook. You can have defined policies contained within the employee handbook that sets clear expectations for both employees and supervisors and managers. And an employee handbook can communicate the values of the organization and the message of the CEO and or founders. So So we also have this handy-dandy chart similar to the employment agreement one that Alex went through earlier. So the first question is, does your organization have an employee handbook? Yes, great, that's awesome. If you don't, that's what we're here for. Utilize our services. We can certainly help draft one with your customized to your organization. The next question you need to consider is whether the employee handbook has been updated in the last 5 years. The failure to regularly update a handbook can expose the organization to significant legal liabilities and inconsistent human resources practices. Keep in mind that the employment standards legislation is always changing, and when it changes, you might need to update your handbook. And we're currently going through a process for all the Alberta handbooks to update all of those so that they are consistent with the new changes that will be effective January 1, 2018. And Ontario changes, stand by. They're currently awaiting royal assent, but once those are formalized, the Ontario employee handbooks are going to need to be revised as well. The next question to consider is whether all employees have signed an acknowledgement that basically confirms that they've read and understood all the policies contained in the employee handbook. If they have, awesome, that's great. If they haven't, keep in mind that the failure to ensure that employees sign off on that acknowledgement form could lend itself to our inability down the line to rely on the terms of the employee handbook. So make sure we're doing an audit, so to speak, every once in a while and making sure that all employees are signing off on that handbook acknowledgement when they commence employment with the company. The last question is whether the employee handbook is consistently applied and adhered to across all areas of the organization. If it is, great, that's why it's there. It's important to use the document that you've spent time and resources investing in. If not, then you're a little bit of a risk to enforce the document. If we don't enforce the document, then we're going to run into some trouble and it may not be enforceable down the line.
And so if you're not going to take our advice and use an employee handbook, and I would urge against that, there are some mandatory policies that you're going to need to have in place regardless of whether you have a handbook or not in most jurisdictions. And those are going to be a health and safety policy that's mandatory in most jurisdictions under health and safety legislation, workplace harassment, and workplace violence. Now, those are important in and of themselves, but at law, you may have someone come in from the Ministry of Labor, Occupational Health and Safety, looking for those policies and even certain kind of procedures, and if they're not in place, there could be some substantial fines or even, in the case of Ontario, imprisonment. Not likely for the failure to have a policy, but it is a remedy that's available, so we're going to want to make sure that we have at least those mandatory policies in place. And for those in Ontario, you've probably spoken to us about what we call AODA, which is the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disability Act. That act does require employers to have certain policies that relate to workplace accommodation and accessibility. I can tell you that other jurisdictions are looking at Ontario and are considering implementing similar legislation. So when that comes down the pipe, we will inform you accordingly. But it's not a bad idea to have those policies in those other jurisdictions just to make sure we're in compliance when it does happen. Now, from a recommended policy standpoint, as Alexandra said, we recommend having the employee handbook. It's just that extra document that's going to make things a lot easier for managers and supervisors as it relates to how the relationship is going to run and what the obligations and entitlements are going to be. So we included a list here, quickly running through some important ones. Our attendance and absenteeism, kind of like what's that process look like? Who do you call? Are they okay to leave a voicemail, email, those types of things? We're going to want to have an electronic communications policy setting out the rules and regulations as it relates to using the electronic commitment equipment and that type of stuff, a privacy policy, the rules around vacation and public holidays, whether you provide sick or personal days and what the rules are associated with that. Obviously, alcohol and substance abuse, and with the recent changes that are upcoming in Canada across the board relating to marijuana, we're going to want to include marijuana use in that policy as well, whether that's for recreational or prescription purposes. If we need a dress code, we want to make sure that's clearly prescribed. If we don't kind of prescribe that and someone shows up in ripped jean shorts, we're going to have a hard time sending them home. So we want to make sure that those expectations are clear. All the rules and regulations around submitting business expenses, that's important, as is if you have a telecommuting workplace, the rules associated therewith. Also, hours of work overtime, performance reviews, anything that relates to conflict of interest and outside employment, we want to address that. Essentially, all the things that aren't going to be addressed necessarily in an employment agreement, because we don't want to have 30-page, 40-page employment agreements, are going to be addressed in your employee handbook. And so Alexandra is going to have some final suggestions on that. I'm going to have some closing thoughts, and then I'll let you get back to your day.
Okay, the employee handbook final suggestion. So all employees should be provided with a copy of the handbook or at least access to an electronic version upon the commencement of their employment and or whenever you develop an employee handbook. The employee handbook acknowledgement should be signed by all employees and maintained in their employee files to indicate their understanding and their acceptance of the policies. The employee handbook should be updated regularly to reflect legislative updates. I went over that before. And we want to make sure managers and supervisors receive regular training on the policies contained in the handbook to ensure that they're actually enforcing the policies. Otherwise, what's the point of having them in the first place?
And so I just want to thank you all for spending your lunch hour with us today. We had a few questions that were submitted, and unfortunately we're not going to have time to get to those right now, but a member of our team will reach out to you at some point this afternoon to address those questions. If you have any other questions that kind of come up as the afternoon or the week progresses, don't hesitate to reach out to our client care team. They will set up a call with an advisor, and we'll get those all squared away. And we'll be back next month with another exciting e-learning opportunity for you. We will send the details as they become available. And again, thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your afternoon, everyone.